Mr. Police, you could have saved her. In honor of the snowman, what's the worst movie tagline?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with something we all lived through and remember so well, even though it's hard to find evidence. Clash of the Titans. Titans will clash.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with a tagline that I assume Roland Emmerich wanted to use on all of his movies, but needed the right subject matter, which would be Godzilla, and the tagline, size does matter.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. But,
fucking bastard.
Hey, and someone's always fucking with my lightning round answer. I only know this because I had the poster in my youth, and the answer is nobody does it better, .. 13 times, and the question is octopussy.
I'm David Ehrlich. I still laugh when people say the word octopussy, and I am going to go with a movie that apparently exists. I have to remind myself because it's a movie starring The Rock about hockey that's also about the Tooth Fairy. Somehow those three things came together. It's the Tooth Fairy, and the tagline is, "You can't handle the tooth."
What else could the tagline possibly have been? What's the point of making the movie if you don't do that?
I do not know.
Great question.
I just do not know.
Could he handle the tooth?
In the end, it turns out he could handle the tooth, and also the real tooth was love.
Yes.
The love of a father for his daughter.
13 times.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 186, and it's Tuesday, October 17th. And on this day in 1888, what a day, Thomas Edison filed the patent for the optical phonograph, which became the first movie projector. I would make a weird joke about Thomas Edison and there being a biopic about him, but there may as well not be one, as we'll get to in our third segment. Before anything in this episode
today
goes dark,
we call them DCPs or projectors or whatever you want. Take your pick.
Different movie.
Anyway, before we get to any of that, we have winners from our contest that we talked about last week.
Yes. Congratulations to Stanley T. I won't dox him on our...
Is it Stanley Tucci?
It's Stanley Tucci. You're the winner of the Girls Trip Blu-ray. No, Stanley T, who commented on our Facebook this week. You know who you are. We'll message you. You message us. Get me your address. You have won a copy of Girls Trip on Blu-ray. So that's that. No other giveaways for now, but more coming up for sure. So keep your ears peeled. Is that right?
Yeah, and keep leaving reviews, and in the meantime, even if there's no prize for it, they are still highly appreciated.
We do have some new reviews to read.
Oh, good. Let's read them.
Hopefully they're not looking for Blu-rays of A Ghost Story or Girls Trip, because...
Listen, whether it's in the text or simply in the subtext, we're all always looking for Blu-rays of Girls Trip and A Ghost Story, so who am I to say? But Chris Throne says Ryan Gosling is ... just like Keanu Reeves. He definitely has a robotic feel to him, but I feel like it fits perfectly in the role he lands, i.e. 2049, Drive, Place Before the Pines, Blue Valentine, Lars and the Real Girl. There's definitely something more to him beneath the surface in his roles, and I think it's a conscious choice. Maybe this is just wishful thinking and a slight bias towards him. I digress. Love the show. Keep talking.
I like that that was a review of Ryan Gosling, not necessarily the podcast.
When it comes to the eternal question of was this review helpful, I have never been more confident about saying yes than it was, because it very instructively told us what to do, which is to keep talking. And in this crazy mixed up world, when it's hard to understand at any given moment what we should be doing, I found that very helpful.
Thank you. To the people who are listening to our conversations and chiming in, I like the idea that you could tweet at us, but you could also just leave us a review and know that we will parrot back your talking points as a review. It's kind of a tricky way to join the conversation. So keep leaving reviews.
Oh, wait. Thank you. Wait. I'm sorry. We have a really, really nice review that I just scanned over that I think deserves to be read on our show.
Okay. This is a very disorganized
breaking news here. It's live. News. We're doing this live. We weren't planning this.
We're doing it live. I was just scanning over this review really quickly while Kiwi was wrapping up, and it seemed like one of those, like, I'm doing finger quotes now, like, real reviews with, like, emotions and poignancy. Whoa. And genuine sentiment. In the rare event that those things happen, klaxons go off in the Fighting in the War Room headquarters. It's all people on deck situation. And so here I am to read it. From Josh Oakley, a podcast that will endure. I love the show, and I'm a bit ashamed it took me so long to review. Patches, can you give me the honor of doing the John Oliver shame on you?
Shame on you! Shame on you, Josh Oakley, waiting this long. Shame on you!
You're all terrific, and I especially love the camaraderie felt in the wedding eps, or just in stories told about your friendships as they relate to art or don't. I had a bit planned when I finally left a review, but since you asked for a moving film memory in honor of a ghost story, it might be too late to enter, but I'll keep going anyway, I'll abandon the bit, which was probably wasn't that funny anyway. For a couple of years, a good friend and I have been recording a pop culture podcast inspired, no part, by yours, that originated as a way to keep in touch when I moved away. Then I moved back for about a year, but this July it was his turn to leave. For our last podcast together in Chicago, we spoke about a ghost story, a film that deeply impacted us both for varying reasons. At one point in the recording, which we never released, he spoke eloquently about walking past a place where we all used to hang out during college, and music bringing out a deep primal emotional state in that memory. He related that to the highlight of the film for both of us. Rooney Mara listening to Casey Affleck's song while sprawled on the ground, recalling him in so many ways, yet unable to fully reach out and touch him ever again. We both started crying and hugged, taking a while to collect ourselves before talking again. Music, film, and television, art of all kind, tethers us to people we love or tolerated, to apartments and bars we used to frequent, to past selves we've shed long ago. It's a bit overwhelming to think about all at once, but it's worth thinking and talking about. I think your podcast has helped me over the years in dark times, and in general as a reminder. There will always be good people talking about beautiful and or ephemeral things. Sometimes we're lucky enough to have them be as entertaining and giving as you all. Thanks, and here's to doing what we can to endure. Well, thank you, Josh Oakley. That's a very...
That was so lovely.
Right. I'd say worth stopping the show dead in its tracks to read.
Yeah, the klaxon does not lead us astray.
I also appreciate the bromantic men being sentimental vibes, friends with one another.
That's why I do this show. Yeah, like hearing friend, dudes talk about their feelings.
Josh and his friend hugging and shedding a tear. It's a lovely moment. Thanks for leaving the review, Josh. We will endure as best we can.
Yeah, and I hope your podcast starts up again. And you are within your bounds to have promoted it and plugged it in that review, and you are still welcome to tweet at us and tell us what it's called. It's the dream.
So for our tidbit today, we're going to be talking about a film that anybody with an internet connection and a Netflix account and or access to a torrent site, I would imagine, because that's where the Netflix movies wind up as soon as they are released.
What?
But don't do that.
What?
Come on. $9 a month.
No, I'm just trying to be as, I don't know, objective as possible about where you can find this movie. You could also
is
go
there
to
a big
theaters.
Netflix torrent culture? Is that I assume there's a torrent culture for everything.
I wouldn't know or be able to speak to that, but when Netflix puts their films on the service, they are all immediately fodder for anyone who wants to steal movies because they're all just there online with no protection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no experience there.
What do I need that for? I have a Netflix account.
I don't know. You just sound pretty shady right now.
Okay. Anyway, get a fucking Netflix account. They are the enemy, but there are or
yet...
they can be the enemy. But that's another conversation for another time. We're talking about the Meyerowitz stories here. Netflix has, by my estimation, release two of the year's very best movies on their service. I wish that they were more widely available to be seen as they were made, but they should be seen all the same, and my grievances with Netflix are not going to block me from telling you as much. The Meyerowitz Stories is the latest film from Noah Baumbach, who you may recognize from The Squid and the Whale, Kicking and Screaming, Mr. Jealousy, Mistress America, Frances Ha, Margot at the Wedding, less likely, but who knows, and De Palma. And now he is back with The Meyerowitz Stories, premiered at Cannes on Netflix now. It stars Dustin Hoffman as the patriarch of a very splintered New York family. He is a angry, resentful artist who made one sculpture in a long, long time ago that is now in a crate somewhere beneath the Whitney. And he has a lot of beef with some of the people around him. He has very particular viewpoints about success and failure and the reasons why he is not particularly successful. It actually, his character seems hatched from a quote from The Squid and the Whale, where Jesse Eisenberg's character is talking about how Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons was his masterpiece, but then it was taken away by the studio, and it was like another genius robbed by the studio system.
Well,
and
the truth about that is that Noah Baumbach's grandfather was this character, basically, that his grandfather was an artist.
You are ruining the punchline of my already long-winded Squid and the Whale reference.
It was so long that I just felt like I'd kill your joke and end this life. You know,
mercy kill my Squid and the Whale reference.
Wow. You know, you're a lot like the Meyerowitz patriarch here.
I am a lot like the Meyerowitz patriarch, and I will tell you why. But
just spinning in circles and trying to
Jesus
tell your jokes.
The point is that Jesse Eisenberg's character had never seen The Magnificent Ambersons. It was just what people said.
Oh, this is still a joke. Okay.
Listen, I'm not even going to do you all the service now of explaining why that is relevant. You'll have to make those connections your own damn selves. Anyway, he has made his children very unhappy because they are all sort of failures in his eyes, or believe that they are failures in his eyes. Adam Sandler is one of his kids. He's newly divorced. He's a struggling musician with a daughter who is sort of the light of the family and is just about to go to college. She's played by Grace Van Patten, who is wonderful. Adam Sandler comes home. His brother is Ben Stiller, who's doing financially well, but is unhappy. He's not an artist, which he knows his dad resents. And then Elizabeth Marvel plays the only daughter. These are all from different marriages. And then the dad, Dustin Hoffman, has a head injury, and they all get together in the hospital. And it's all about families and resentment and what it means to be successful. And also something that all of Noah Baumbach's films are about, which are lives in transition and also our image of ourselves. And Emma Thompson, who plays Dustin Hoffman's character's current girlfriend, as like a daffy British lady alcoholic in this movie, has that line where she talks about our conceptions of ourselves and how we're so hung up on who we think we are. Anyway, this is a great, great movie. I've seen it a couple times now. It only grows in my estimation every time. I think, you know, Adam Sandler has not... It goes without saying that he hasn't been this good since Funny People and Punch Drunk Love before that. But he is truly excellent here. It is just another punch in the gut for when you wonder why he doesn't want to do this more often. Dustin Hoffman's fantastic. I think the characters are so well drawn. Elizabeth Marvel is I'd sooner see wait for it, the Elizabeth Marvel cinematic universe than I would.
No? I've been hearing more about her than anybody else in the cast, actually. Sorry, Dave, did I step on your Marvel joke?
No, I think he
stepped on his Marvel groan.
Oh. All right. Talk to me about Elizabeth Marvel, because I feel like at the whole like Adam Sandler's acting again is the big thing that should be the hook, but it's mostly just people wanting the Elizabeth Marvel cinematic universe.
Well, he is. If this movie has a lead character, it is Adam Sandler, and he deserves all of the praise that he's getting. And of course, there is always that surprise when he decides to bust out one of these deeply felt dramatic performances. And his relationship with his daughter in this movie is really touching, and as is his relationship. Well, his relationship with Dustin Hoffman's character is less touching, but also very honest. Dustin Hoffman's character is kind of an unredeemable asshole, or irredeemable, I should say. But Elizabeth Marvel is wonderful. You may know her from the stage, which I didn't. You may know her from What's that show? It's very popular. it's on. Oh, it's about terrorists. Showtime.
She's
Homeland.
On Homeland.
Homeland.
She is in. She's in Lincoln. She plays, I think, Tommy Lee Jones's daughter. Wow. Or someone. She has a minor role in Lincoln, but I remember her from it.
She's on a lot of things.
She is extraordinary in this movie. Jean is. What's interesting about Jean's character is she sort of seems to be a wallflower. She's very quiet. She's the only girl in this sort of remaining.
And she's the oldest.
Family. She's the oldest. I don't want to put too fine a point on this, given the sensitivity of the topic, but it is relevant to recent events. There is a very funny sequence, ultimately funny, not at first, where it's revealed that she was sexually harassed as a child but her performance is so contained, but it's also there's so much joy and hope in this performance because she sort of represents this balance of happiness and like only being
a true like kooky aunt made human, right? Like there's someone in every family, it seems like, who's just kind of in a different orbit, and despite the fact that gravity pulls them towards your family, they're just like they're in their own universe, and this really humanizes that type of person who has always lived their own way, who may not be in a relationship, and it just brings her down to earth and talks about her issues, why she's kind of separate from the family, and it's not all about this issue, you know, it's not that dark. She's just generally separated from everyone because she didn't get love from her dad, and she's not close to her brothers, but she loves being involved. At some point they're drinking and playing songs, and they ask her, like, why do you stick around in this family that belittles you and doesn't recognize you as a person? And she's like, because I just love hanging out with you guys. And I thought that she's was a really, good, really poignant.
She's a good person. Matt is right in that the sexual harassment stuff I referenced is not meant to be this like defining part of who she is. She's found her own source of happiness. She is not an artist necessarily, but she makes these little movies at her office that we actually don't get to see, but she mentions them. It's clear they bring her some real happiness. It's a really interesting counterpoint to the other characters. Dave and Katie, have you seen this movie?
Nope. I'm not yet. Looking forward to it.
It's really great. I don't know. I think that it is pound for pound. I think it's the strongest. Like Noah Baumbach without Greta Gerwig worries me a little bit, because I think that my favorite films of his have been the ones that he's made with her. And then I saw Lady Bird, which is so phenomenal. And I was getting a little worried that the things that I thought I liked about Noah Baumbach were really just things that I liked about Greta Gerwig, and I wouldn't really be interested in Noah Baumbach on his own. But this film very smartly sort of reasserts his own voice. I'm not saying that I prefer it to the ones he made with Greta Gerwig. I certainly don't prefer it to Lady Bird, but it's so...
Compared to those movies, you know, I think Greta Gerwig brings the young person's perspective to a Mistress America or a Frances Ha, and you have this like mixing of worlds and this transition, these transition movies about figuring out your life as you grow up. And this movie is very much about being grown up and looking backwards and figuring out if there's still room to grow or room for reflection, and if when does your life end? Is it when you die, or is it years ago when you made a mistake or when you got too caught up in your own world? I mean, I guess that's melancholy.
Are we all dead already?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what this movie is about. But the answer is you're not dead already. You just have to make new choices. And you know what's interesting about Noah Baumbach is in the television occasion of movie scripts, and Netflix is the perpetrator here, where it's like, oh, I couldn't get this movie made, so now it's going to be a 10-episode Netflix series or something, which I think is so detrimental to the stories being told in that way and stretched out and expanded. Here's a guy who can make something that seems so fit for television, like the Meyerowitz stories could easily be an HBO series. I could pick up with these characters over and over and over again, and I would love to do that. But I'm so glad that we get a sliver of their lives at this exact moment, and it's kind of told in multiple parts. You get Danny Adam Sandler's story first, and then you get to meet Ben Stiller's character, Matthew, and then you get the Gene stuff, and then it kind of all converges when the when Dustin Hoffman's character Harold winds up in the hospital. It could easily be television, but it's not. It's extremely cinematic and highly it's stylized in a naturalistic way. I always find that really interesting. That Noah Baumbach, there's no improv on these sets. I heard a great interview with him on Fresh Air the other day where he's just like, no, people come in and they read my script. They know that's what I want to do. And you can tell from the dialogue. It's very considered and it's very rhythmic, but it still feels so tangible. It's so real.
Yeah. Two very important points to what you're making. The first is this movie is the Maya Horowitz stories new and selected, which speaks to the structure of the film and also the idea of sort of like family myth making. It is a little bit of a pompous title. We were all laughing at it at Cannes, sight unseen, but it really is well considered in context of the movie. The other thing is to Patch's point about how it's shot. This was shot on film, which is the first Noah Baumbach film in a while.
And you can tell on even on Netflix, I gotta say.
Yeah. By Robbie Ryan. And there are it's a very, very well shot film. I mean, not only the sort of patina of the film grain, but also, I mean, there are great tracking shots, though there's real energy to the scenes in the hospital. There are so many great edits and great camera moves.
There are so many great edits.
The camera. And Noah Baumbach told me in so many words that he will never, ever, ever work with Netflix again. So, because he, it drives him fucking bonkers that this movie is not widely available to be seen in theaters.
What is a theatrical release for it? Like at this point,
it's just in the iPick. I mean, there may be a few one offs at like Film Society, Lincoln Center or something. I don't know. But it's mainly with. As with all Netflix theatrical releases with the iPick cinema chain, which is some garbage.
Wait a second. I'm not sure that's true. We should get a fact check on that because I'm pretty sure that it's open in select theaters across the country.
Select iPick theaters.
I don't know about that.
They have an exclusive deal with iPick. So they can arrange other situations, like when Okja screened at the Beverly.
Well, for instance, I just looked up in Chicago, like it's playing the Landmark Century Center Cinema in Chicago. I don't think that's an iPick theater, but not to. I know you. This is a fire inside of you, burning down Netflix. But I'm just saying, I think this is an expanded situation beyond iPick.
That would be huge news. I don't think it's true. They may have negotiated individual deals on a city by city basis, but. Netflix theatrical. I mean, listen, if it's, I'm not going to like push back against reality. I'm just saying that, like, as far as I know, this is the situation. And,
it's only at Lincoln Plaza in New York City.
Yeah.
No, it's playing at the IFC Center right now.
Okay. Fandango did not pull it up.
Is it? It's playing at the IFC Center?
Yes.
Great. I mean, like,
we're getting myopic here, but the point is, well, no, it's interesting how Netflix has catered to Noah Baumbach because it's definitely in a wider release than the iPick thing, I think. And then if you watch it on Netflix, they actually give it a pretty nice, you know, it doesn't open with a bum bum Netflix. It's like a quiet Netflix intro plus it's like a real film. It's like you're not watching the next episode that just preloaded on Netflix. And it doesn't actually auto play into anything either, which is interesting.
Nice.
It doesn't like automatically kick into the Ridiculous Six since you love Adam Sandler movies.
When Scott Rudin picks up the phone and yells at the computer technician on the far wherever that he needs to treat this movie with special, I don't know. It does sound, I was not aware that it was playing the IFC Center. Patches says that's being a little bit myopic. I disagree. I think it's a really important point. I think that all of these places where it's playing that are outside of the IPIC chain were probably hard won and negotiated on an individual basis. And it's nice to know that they're willing to do that sometimes. It will not change Noah Baumbach's mind, I assure you. but unless they dramatically scale up.
If a movie called The Meyerowitz Stories New and Selected was not playing at Lincoln Plaza, that would be just completely on the table.
But it's, you know, I spoke to him about the Jewish thing because, you know, I'm like, oh, this is a movie about a Jewish family. It feels like a movie about a Jewish family. And I think it feels that way in addition to the last name because they are sort of, religion doesn't play a role in their lives, that art becomes the sort of, you know, religious factor then, and the hierarchy of values that comes from that. And it occurred to me after watching the movie for a second time that they never mention anything that can be ascribed to Jewish culture. in explicitly, and, you know, talking to Noah Baumbach, thinking about it, it's like, yes, his mom was Jewish. His dad was Jewish. His mom was not, I believe. And so the last name was there, but they were not technically Jewish. But, you know, it's that same dynamic. Anyway.
I mean, it's got Shark the three, like, biggest Jewish movie stars in the last 40 years. Like, I'm trying to think of who they are leaving out. Like, it definitely has all the signifiers.
It's a movie that is what our friend of the podcast, Jordan Hoff, would call good for the Jews.
I mean, Judd Hirsch is in this movie. Is Sigourney Weaver a Jew? She's in this movie. Everyone's in this
Sigourney
movie.
Weaver is great in this movie.
Dave, will you play the segment on the Hanukkah song?
Sure.
Because that's the only Jewish song ever written.
No, wow. Is Sigourney Weaver a Jew just made me think of the O.J. Simpson not a Jew line.
It's time for Hanukkah. So much Hanukkah to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we get eight crazy nights. But when you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's a list of people who are Jewish, just like you and me.
It's I, your local Jewish host, and I'm sorry that you'll have to hear more of my voice. I'm going to quiet down in the third part of our episode today, but I am, at the time of this recording, the only person who has seen the movie that we are talking about for our mini segment, so you gotta have a little bit more of me at the moment. It's Wonder Wheel by everyone's favorite Jew, Woody Allen.
Everyone's which, favorite.
He's very popular right now.
Undisputed.
Yes, objectively, everyone's favorite Jew. I'm just digging a hole. So let's just talk about Wonder Wheel. It's a Woody Allen movie. You already know if you want to A, see it, B, not see it, or C, not see it and yell at everyone who does see it.
I feel like that's objectively not true, though, because the whole thing with Woody Allen is that he makes four bad movies, and then the fifth one is something that people are like, oh, I know you're not into the last couple ones, but this is the one you should see. By my count, the last one was Blue Jasmine.
There is absolutely truth to that. However, I feel like in our current cultural climate, a lot of people are just done.
Oh, sure. No, the third category you're talking about, that I totally, people who just will never want to see it. But I've always felt like I felt more of a middle thing where it's like, I'm generally not here for the thing he's putting down, but like, I'm glad I saw Blue Jasmine or Midnight in Paris.
Yeah, I mean, we reached a point a few years ago, and this is sort of, you know, regardless of the quality of the movies or lack thereof, where I started getting yelled at for simply seeing Woody Allen movies and reviewing them. And I felt like the worm was sort of turning there. And I, you know, obviously, a lot of other things have happened in the world that have led us to this point, but there is definitely a larger vocal faction of people that just don't give a shit anymore, and I think there would be a lot of pushback in the very unlikely event at this point that he made some sort of masterpiece that everyone was championing. I think it would be a tense situation, but Wonder Wheel is not that masterpiece, I assure you. It is a good old-fashioned slice of period Woody. Which is a really ugly combination of words.
Yeah, I gagged a little there.
It is set in the 1950s in Coney Island. It's shot by Vittorio Storaro, who makes the entire thing look like a Vanity Fair photo shoot. It is saturated to hell and back. I could not believe what it was like. I mean, to think of it as like an Instagram photo with the saturation filter turned all the way up. Would not even get you there. I really, Vanity Fair photo shoot was the first thing that came to mind for me.
I can't tell if you're insulting my place of business or not.
I am not. It's just a particular look.
I don't feel like Vanity Fair portraits are that saturated. I feel like Tim Burton movies might be a better touchstone here. Are they super saturated?
What?
Yeah, like whenever he does dream sequences.
Tim Burton movies can be saturated, but
like Sweeney Todd.
combining the saturation factor with the particular milieu and like so many shots of a like damp Kate Winslet in a 1950s era bathing suit sitting on the beach. It's very, very Vanity Fair. But we can pick over that if anyone ever wants to talk about this movie again, which is debatable. But it is a story. I mean, and I enjoyed the film for what it is. It's definitely not bottom of the barrel Woody. It's somewhere tonally. It's not like as dark as Match Point. It's a morality story about, like all of his films now tend to be very simple morality plays that turn on one action or choice that a character makes that has, you know, usually terrible consequences. Kate Winslet is a housewife who, she's a really interesting character, I found. You know, she's someone who, she's not a housewife, sorry, but she lives in Coney Island. She used to be an actress. She refuses to accept the fact that she's a waitress now in Coney Island. She, like, she's like, I'm not a waitress. I'm just playing this as a part. You know, like, this is not who I am and was meant to be. She lives with Jim Belushi, who is a big old 1950s sitcom character type. And his daughter, who is running away from the mob, returns home, and his daughter is Juno Temple. And
Juno Temple in a Woody Allen movie does feel like a punchline. Like, that, it's just, I don't know what happens to her from there, but I just feel like I can guess.
You know, the basic premise is that there's a lifeguard who is narrating the movie for Breaking the Fourth Wall, Ferris Bueller style, played by Justin Timberlake. That is how the movie opens. A lot of people might head for the door right away. I like Justin Timberlake as an actor. I was just rewatching The Social Network. He's fantastic in it. This part is a little tin-eared. But he starts having an affair with Kate Winslet, and then he starts giving the eye to Juno Temple, and there's a big old love square. And things go awry, and it ends a lot more dramatically than it started. And a lot of it is about sort of less nostalgia than just wanting a better life for yourself and giving yourself enough dramatic your life enough dramatic sweep for it to match your ambitions. It's fine. It's slight. There are two very, very long takes towards the end of the film where the Tennessee Williams of it all. I mean, there's so many long scenes of this movie set inside their house by the beach where the camera hardly moves and it feels like you could be watching theater, where Kate Winslet really gets a chance to shine. I think the character is an interesting character, but it's not as well baked as I think a lot of her best roles. I think that maybe Vittorio Storaro gets some attention for his very flashy, but to my mind, a little artificial cinematography. Artificial is not necessarily a bad thing, but here it's very, very heightened. I don't know. It sort of works with what they're doing, but also sort of gets in the way. It's fine. I watched it and I moved on. It does not hit you with the force of Match Point, which felt like a real resurrection for him, and had some real vitality to it. I don't think Kate Winslet's performance is as monumental in a way, or at least as loud and intense as Kate Blanchett's was in Blue Jasmine. So I do think that this one will ultimately be filed away with a lot of other first draft Woody Allen movies, despite its December release date, which is giving it this air of importance.
Well, it's coming.
Maybe it could be filed away with the bottom of the barrel Woody action figure.
Sure.
There, as far as I'm concerned.
Now I'm looking at all the movies, Woody Allen movies, I forget, like To Rome with Love.
Yeah.
To Rome with Love is
two?
Oh, yeah. To Rome with Love is bottom. It's like underneath the barrel. It is. That is not a good film.
David, I forgot to ask in the last segment, you said Netflix had two of the best movies of the year. What was the other one?
Okja.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Okja.
Magic in the Moonlight.
Love that Okja.
Super Pig.
We may revisit this. I'd be curious to hear what my co-hosts have to say about Wonder Wheel. It opens in the beginning of December, so hang on to that thought for now. But if the one person out there who is really expecting or hoping for greatness, I might temper your expectations. We'll be right back.
We recorded this, we managed not to talk at all about the ongoing Harvey Weinstein story, which I think says something about how fast this has all been happening. Like, it's been less than 2 weeks since the New York Times published a story in which women for the first time went on the record accusing him of sexual assault. The New Yorker followed up less than a week later with their own story. Since then, the count is maybe at like 38 or so people who have come forward with stories about him doing everything from, you know, inviting them to his hotel room, showing up in robe, and they left, to rape. The stories are horrifying. The fallout has been kind of remarkably swift given how long, it's been described as an open secret. You know, there's a sense that people have known that about this for a long time. He's been stripped of his Academy membership. He's been fired from his company, the Weinstein Company. No matter what Paddington 2 may hold in store, seems to be relatively done as a going concern.
We'll Could there be Weinstein a more, a more innocent film that is, collateral damage and all of this? I mean, Paddington, it's one of the rare movies that is just like a blast of light and joy into this sick, sad world.
The crazy thing is that it's in the UK, it's being distributed by Studio Canal, so it has nothing to do with any of this. And the royals, William and Harry and Kate, were all at Paddington Station dancing with Paddington Bear today. Basically rubbing it into the Weinstein Company's face, I guess.
Like, Paddington will survive.
It's
tulip fever we have to worry about.
That poor bear deserves better. Anyway, Katie, please continue. I'm sorry.
So, I mean, obviously there are a lot of angles on this. I don't think we need to stand here and say that we think sexual assault and abuse of power is wrong. I think we can all agree on that. But the thing that I find myself genuinely struggling with, and this is something that we've talked about a lot, but not in this context, is the idea of separating the artist from the work. I mean, Woody Allen's a great example of this that people have struggled with. And the Weinstein Company and Harvey Weinstein have been involved in 20 years of indie film and have shaped a ton of things that they had nothing to do with. I mean, you get Quentin Tarantino's entire career just for a really small starting point. And my initial instinct is to say, no way, I'm going to watch Shakespeare in Love and be just fine with it. But I'm having a really hard time doing that. Like, it's the idea of sitting down to watching it, knowing that Gwyneth Paltrow had to turn him down and have Brad Pitt yell at him for doing it to be able to make that movie. I don't know. I don't know if this is a turning of the tide and maybe separating the artist from the art isn't as easy as it used to be, or if the Weinstein case is so bad and so linked to the production of all these movies that it's more difficult for me. And I guess maybe to start, I'm curious if anyone else is having the same struggle.
Well,
I go,
Dave, go.
Me. Yeah. Me, Patches. Yeah, Dave. I sort of am, mostly because I'm not a big fan, but the book Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, yeah, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film.
It's a great book.
Really paints like a certain portrait of that 90s period of, you know, indie studios sort of coming to rise, and what we consider like our independent film growing up coming to pass. And because it was stuff while I was growing up, like, I remember, you know, Pulp Fiction and Desperado and all these little Miramax films that could. And now we're in a situation where everybody who has been involved with Harvey Weinstein, and even, you know, everybody in the entertainment industry, is being asked this question about what their perspective on it is. And I found myself, just by happenstance of paying attention to what's happening in the community, becoming disappointed in, like, directors whose craft or early films I really appreciated, them sort of like, I get to be really specific. Really, I like Robert Rodriguez. He's a Hispanic dude who made it on his own. He sort of like left his wife for Rose McGowan, which wasn't super cool, but you know, people make romantic decisions all the time that I don't have to agree with. That's fine. But then he did Grindhouse, which features Rose McGowan very prominently, and turned around and sold it to the Weinstein Company, So now, knowing what we know about Rose McGowan and Harvey Weinstein, it seems almost impossible that that wasn't like letting something happen, or, you know, just assuming that's the business. And we're talking about Grindhouse, a, you know, Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino dual film that didn't need to be made. So at some point, looking back at these things that I used to just see as like interesting little experiments or people's debuts, and the meta story of how they were created makes me take a second look at them in a way that I hadn't before.
But Grindhouse is a pretty disposable movie, particularly Robert Rodriguez's section. Would it make a difference to you if Grindhouse was a personal favorite?
Maybe. Like, if Quentin Tarantino comes out with a horrible take in like 2 weeks,
oh god, he definitely
I have
is.
To rethink all
he
of.
So is.
It's going to be 400 pages if long and written by hand.
Well, it's like now, like, if that, you know, becomes like a weird take, do I start like thinking about like Quentin Tarantino, you know, inviting Harry Knowles to a set visit for Kill Bill? Do I think about Quentin Tarantino idolizing Uma Thurman's feet beyond actually just being a film like fetish? Like, is this going to, is it so systematic that the responsible thing to do is to rethink how I think about film history? Like, is this the event that makes us all go back and do that? Like, we can't separate the artist from the art, but if it is the industry, we can't really separate the industry from the art.
Yeah.
But in some way, isn't that letting the work of the actresses involved, like, be in vain in some ways? I mean, the reason many of them found themselves in this position is because they wanted to do what they love, and they got twisted in this position by a horrible man. But that's like, their work is in vain if you decide not to watch the many movies that this monstrous human has produced. I mean, I don't know. These women are so good in many of these movies. I don't want to not watch Gwyneth Paltrow and Shakespeare in Love, because Gwyneth Paltrow and Shakespeare in Love is very good. So why would I ignore that work and know that she suffered to be able to do that and give her Oscar-winning performance?
And my dilemma is extending it even further. And, like, I mean, John Madden hasn't made a statement. I don't know what he knew and when he knew it. But, you know, I imagine he had very little control over what the distributor of his movie was doing. And the stories about Harvey Weinstein have been that he chops up people's movies against their will. And I don't want to punish him either. You know, there's a lot of good people or good enough people making good work within the umbrella.
I mean, do you believe that stuff? These people did not know, or is it? I mean, it seems possible that they wouldn't have known, or that he's a creep and that you just need to stay away from him. I mean, a lot of people in these situations have given that line, where it's like, we kind of knew, but we couldn't have known this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, to what extent are we implicating people for, you know, what they knew and didn't say? Because I think a whole part of this narrative and the story that we're telling, for both women who were victims and, you know, men who were not a party to the crimes, maybe aware of them to some degree or another, is that it was incredibly difficult for both to come forward and to say something. And there was a real whisper system set up so that they could steer the people they knew away from meeting with Harvey Weinstein. But
it felt like omerta.
They didn't. Yeah, I mean, I think I struggle with this blame game, this very punitive idea of, you know, you were someone who knew and we'll brand you for that. I think it's very easy for us from where we're sitting, and I don't want to let anyone off the hook either, but I just always want to be cognizant of how much easier it is to sit where we are and cast judgment. And I say this as a critic. It's my job to cast judgment on things from a chair comfortably, you know, that I did not labor to make. But it's just easier for us to say these things than it is to know what we would do in those situations. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that our friend of the podcast, friend of real life, Griffin Newman's story about working, doing one scene in Woody Allen's next movie, what went a little viral on the internet was that it was someone very honestly grappling with the sort of emotional tumult of doing something that he learned the process of doing, he like really deeply disagreed with and was struggling with his own feelings. And it was just an honest window into what it feels like to actually have to wrestle with these things rather in a practical way rather than just purely theoretically.
Right. In Griffith's case, it was after the fact, right? He's caught right. in this vortex. It's like, I'm not saying that this is what Griffin was dealing with, but it's like, can you imagine if someone was deciding to make a movie with Harvey Weinstein now? Like, I guess the answer would be clear, but if you kind of knew what Harvey Weinstein was up to, but maybe weren't sure of the extent, and then he gave you the offer of a lifetime, or, we get to make another movie. It's like, you can, in retrospect, I mean, Griffin kind of had made his mind up about Woody Allen, and then only after doing it feels that it's the guilt that brings him to this confession. I don't know. You get caught in a vortex of professional... accomplished.
I don't want to get caught in the vortex of parsing the difference between what Harvey Weinstein did and
well, what I'm
Woody
saying
Allen
is impossible.
Did, but,
like it's very difficult to do so.
Yeah, but I think one of the positives. This is systemic misogyny and abuse. I mean, it's terrible, but I do think one of the positives of everybody. Being so vocal about it, of this community bringing out into the open, exposing the sickness, is that it will give people, particularly sensitive people who want to do the right thing and want to not harm anybody by virtue of chasing their dreams and so on, pause to think about these things and be more reflective than they may have been otherwise. And I think the process, I'm not judging the action one way or the other. I have no idea what I would have done in Griffin's situation. I can only hope that I would have handled it with that amount of class and honesty. But I think that the sheer fact that these women coming forward to talk about this prompted him to search his own soul, I think is a really positive sign.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I want from the people that I was talking about. Like, I don't want to judge them for what they did or did not know and when they know it. What I want them is to come forward and take a stand, and then I get to decide. Like, it's the people that you're always like half worried about anyway, like the Kevin Smiths and the Ben Afflecks and the Tarantinos, where you're like, that looks like a boys club from the outside. That's how they're selling it. And then all of a sudden you realize that includes like horrible behavior. I don't think Kevin Smith is sexually harassing people, but I think Kevin Smith should be smart enough and has been smart enough to come out and just say, like, yeah, this guy made my career, but, like, absolutely not. I think that's a question we should be asking of our, male cohorts that are high enough up to wield this power, because what we're really asking is, should we be watching you closer? I don't think we're accusing anybody of, like, guilt, but, like we were talking about in rooting out, like a fandom curing itself of toxic parts of the community, like forcing that in a business is hard because it involves the audience being the only people that could speak truth to money for a long period of time. And luckily, we've started a groundswell here. We just have to sort of like keep it focused and responsible. Like, I don't think they're bad questions to ask. I just don't think they're like,
it
should be easy for everybody to come out and,
I mean, there's so many.
I think it should be easy to come out and say sexual assault is bad. And then also that makes it easier to come out to spotlight the people that could come out and not say that.
Right. But look, looking at some of the responses to what Griffin was posting, there are just so many. The internet can feel like a place where it's very dangerous to ask questions or to look for answers because people are. There's just so many bad faith assumptions. People are so hungry to spread blame around. Some of those people have more of a reason to do that than others, but it's not obviously the most conducive environment for the kind of discussions that need to be had. But I was thinking about this in terms of Joss Whedon's whole brew, whatever you want to call it, a month ago, whenever the hell it was now, it's hard to keep track of time anymore. That was a different situation, but it was another guy who was accused in a letter that, its merits can be debated by his ex-wife and the rap of all places about him using his power to prey on fans and women and just, more or less just being a shitty man. And I was just thinking a lot about that in relation to his art and how, you know, a lot of people would say on the surface that it would invalidate his art, which, you know, was fueled by feminist ideals and female strength and so on. And I don't know. I mean, I think I definitely see that argument, but I also think that all people are flawed, some a lot more than others, but that art oftentimes, not in all cases, but oftentimes, and this, I think this applies to the Buffy universe, is not about who we are, but about who we would like to be and about the ideals that we have and the values that we aspire to achieve in our own lives and our own selves. And so I think that it doesn't necessarily invalidate art for there to be that gap between, and I'm speaking the most general terms here, not drawing Woody Allen and Harvey Weinstein and all those people into this mix, but I'm just saying in a more innocent and broader way, I think a lot of the value of art is in the distance between our iniquities, our own shortcomings, and the ideals that we strive for in art. I mean, like, every movie ends with a moment of great, for not every movie, so many movies, particularly Hollywood movies, end with a moment of reconciliation, of people forgiving one another, of coming together and overcoming their fears. We are fucking awful at that in real life. And yet we don't do anything to change it. We accept we want to be punitive and punishing to the people in our own personal lives. And yet that's one of the ideals that we celebrate because we wish deep down that we were better at that. And that was something.
Well, we don't have the ability to do that because the credits are in. They're not on the horizon. It never ends. Yes, we're never in a final act here.
That is the actually, you can go back to the Meyerowitz stories where they teach you about how you can, when saying goodbye to a parent, you can find the five things to say that can sort of bring down the credits on your relationship. But again, that's the idea of the credits sort of having an endpoint there is part of what separates art. I do think that we, in our rush to judge people, can, and again, I can't stress enough how much I am not speaking to this in terms of how we should think about someone like Harvey Weinstein. I just think that that's something to keep in mind when talking about art. Katie?
I mean, I want to just go back to more really specific ways that we look at these legacies and these movies as consumers. Like, I've been thinking on the really broad sense, like, do I think that the pyramids are less amazing because they were built with slave labor? Do I think that The Wizard of Oz is less amazing because Judy Garland was being tortured while she was making that movie? And I mean, I think time makes it easy to overlook a lot of this stuff, but I mean, just for all of us, just kind of lay our cards on the table. Like, I think it's gonna be a while before I rewatch Shakespeare in Love or Talented Mr. Ripley or something else from this era.
Or The Nut Job, or Jane Got a Gun, or Burnt.
Usually rewatch on a weekly basis. So Dave kind of waited on his dilemma about Robert Rodriguez. Patches, what about you? Like, personally, do you feel like you can dive back into all this stuff without thinking about Weinstein?
I mean, I don't really think of these movies as Harvey Weinstein movies. I guess I could. I mean, the narratives are disturbing to me, what went into getting certain people into movies or the wheeling and dealing. I mean, but then again, there's a schizophrenia to these Harvey Weinstein stories where, you know, he was a great contributor to politics, and he was a movie mogul who got these movies made and got people into these movies. I mean, his horrible acts seem kind of divorced from it too. And I don't know. It's difficult for me to see his fingerprints all over everything. And the movies don't feel damaged to me. I guess I'm clinging to the idea that these actresses' work would be in vain if we were to turn our backs to them and give him the win or something, as if everything that they've done to this point being violated by him has tarnished their legacy too. Why should
or it defines them like that?
Exactly. To bring up the Meyerowitz stories again, you know, Gene wasn't defined.
Episodes. Holistic.
Brought to you by the Meyerowitz stories. You know, we were talking about how this one act doesn't define her, and she can actually be like, the work that she's created in the past is still vibrant, and she's encouraged by talking about it with people, and she looks forward. I would hope that someone like Gwyneth Paltrow or Ashley Judd could be really proud of the work they put out there, even though this is an extremely haunting moment and it's intrinsically tied to the work that they've done, I want to be proud of what they do and enjoy their work. I don't want his shadow to loom over it, even though on some level he made it possible. I guess I just don't understand what he's done that would ruin these movies for people or tarnish these performances. He's not part of this.
I think really. It's just hard for me to not to think of watching Shakespeare in Love and Gwyneth Paltrow particularly and not have that in my memory. Like, oh, just thinking of what she had to overcome to get to the point that she was there. And,
right.
And especially the movies that we think of where he recut them and like the idea of Harvey Scissorhands. Like, his actions are on a lot of these movies, not necessarily all the sexual assault ones.
Right. Maybe the problem is I haven't watched one of these movies in the wake of this, and I don't know if
you
I'll
haven't
be sitting
rewatched
there.
Tulip Fever.
Yeah, well, I've watched Tulip Fever many, many times, and I'll never give up my dear Tulip Fever. I actually didn't realize Cara Delevingne was in Tulip Fever until she spoke out against Harvey Weinstein. So, I mean, if there's a silver lining, I guess I'm learning more about the movies through Harvey Weinstein. That sounds terrible. But, I would have to go back to one of these movies and maybe I will see his fingerprints on them. But I hope not. I hope that they be... through it, and that I'm encouraged by the art that's come out of these horrible moments in time.
I can't pretend that I would be able to sort of like disavow a film like Shakespeare in Love, which I have all but memorized. It may be that when I watch it the next time, I no longer see it through whatever rose-colored glasses I've always seen it through, or all the things I enjoy. It may be tainted. It's obviously going to be tainted, but it may be tainted in a way that really makes me want to change the channel. But I guess I find it easier to be more focused on films that haven't come out yet. In the case of Harvey Weinstein, that is not really an issue because it doesn't sound like he's ever going to be making movies again. With somebody like, I don't know, Victor Salva, which is a name that a lot of people might not recognize, but he's the director of the Jeepers Creepers.
Yeah, you know,
films.
Sci-Fi's airing Jeepers Creepers 3 right. this in
Jeepers
like
Creepers
next
3
week.
Played in theaters for one day only last month.
And like that, it would be, you know, it's a lot easier and more practical for me not to form new relationships with these films, knowing what it is that I know. But everybody has to, I've always maintained that everybody has to draw their own line in the sand, and everybody's personal line will move as they get older.
That's
and
what I,
more and know. So on.
That's what I was about to say. I just wanted to follow up on my own comment, which was basically like, I can imagine someone being triggered by the Weinstein Company logo, frankly. I could totally understand if you have experienced sexual assault or something horrifying in your life. You know, I was really... both my jaw dropped and I was inspired by all the hashtag Me Too messages I was seeing all over Facebook and Twitter in the past few days. I mean, it's really impressive that people will speak out and encourage others to do that and stand in solidarity. I think it's a beautiful thing. And I won't be surprised if some people can never watch any movie that has the Weinstein or Miramax logo in front of it ever again because it reminds them of something in their own life. That seems fine to me. I would never be like, you must love Shakespeare in Love. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. And it totally sucks. It sucks that like one shitty person's actions get to take and invalidate an entire catalog of films, of really important films.
But let's look back.
Totally,
I mean,
valid reason.
How many films are we really losing here? Zach and Miri Make a Porno.
I don't think we're losing films. What we're losing is the history, which became like a myth, which was like, this movie was nothing. Harvey Weinstein came in and through sheer force of will made it this thing that it is now. Uh-huh. That's the history that needs to be undone. The movies are going to stay the movies, thank God, because he's not Victor Salva and, you know, making powder. That's fine. I feel like at some point I'll be able to return to, you know, the Miramax and the Weinstein Company films. It's just the history of them can't be what it was for the decade
and
plus that we were saying, like, this is the champion of
independent film. It's an earthquake through the history
of this bullheaded guy who got things done.
Yeah.
It's like, no, he's this bully serial harasser that got things done.
And the thing that I was thinking of when I wanted to have this conversation was The Cosby Show, which is this like enormous landmark in television. It was so influential to so many people our age who grew up with it, to television as a whole. And as a culture, we've just kind of stopped talking about it. And I think the easiest thing to do, and may always be the easiest thing to do, is just kind of just strike it from the collective memory, basically. And I don't think that the films that Harvey Weinstein produced or distributed are going to be as easy to write out, but I do worry that we're just going to like stop talking about Pulp Fiction the way that we might have, because it's got such a complicated
but you don't pop in Pulp Fiction and have to look at Harvey Weinstein. You don't have to go stare him in the face. And I think that's a huge difference. I mean, don't watch the episode of Doll and M on HBO that Harvey Weinstein is in, you know.
Ugh.
Don't watch that episode. I know you want to watch it. It's the premiere of the second season, but don't watch Doll and M.
What about all those episodes of Entourage with the thinly masked Harvey Weinstein character? Are those just dead to culture now?
Wait, were there
those were dead to culture
who weren't thinly masked
a long time ago?
Harvey Weinstein characters? I mean, that's like Harvey Weinstein the show. I mean,
he was the inspiration for Turtle?
I mean, I think like the pervasive sexism of Entourage has not aged well, regardless. But I think I'm not going to say that Entourage is the real pariah here. But I really think whatever last embers of affection people might have for that show are about to be snuffed out.
Can I make a controversial statement to end this? And I don't know if this would be a big argument or not, but I wanted to hear this out.
It's a good way to end it.
Okay, I think that politicians should not have to give his money back or give it to a charity or whatever. I mean, he supported worthy causes over his career. That money is not stolen. It is made on the power of these movies that we're talking about. I think distancing yourself from him is obviously the right thing to do. But I don't think you should have to give the money back.
Well, they don't have to give it back. But the problem is, if you read my Facebook page where my Trump-loving family talks about why I'm not like chiming in on the Harvey Weinstein scandals, even though I have plenty of problems with Trump, it's been weaponized. This is not, it's not that they have to give it back, perhaps, but that they have to do it to show that they can handle people like this within their community, right? They are better than this. This is not a systemic problem within like the Democratic Party or something, but it's being turned against them in that way. So they have to give the money back.
Listen, when the Republican Party completely abandons Trump and sends him bouncing on his fat fucking ass out of the White House because he's a deplorable serial monster in every way possible, then maybe the Democratic politicians should consider giving the money back. Until then, I'm with Katie.
Thank you.
You're with her.
I'm also with Katie, but I think the important thing that we all got to at the end of this conversation is there's one episode of Doll and M nobody can watch anymore.
I would also avoid David the Gnome, which the Weinstein Company produced and brought over to television.
Oh, what?
So watch out for the credits. That's
a
trigger warning.
I am flying to London to see Paddington in a way that
will... So you can see it without the Weinstein logo?
Right, but also in a way that's not going to put money in their coffers. So
there you go.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week. In the meantime, tell me what you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes. You can share them with people with a handy link, where you can leave comments on each episode. We'll read them, process them, throw them back in the other episodes. Do it.
Except Scooter. Sorry, Scooter, nobody's answered your Jared Leto question.
How long? Wait, I thought I checked for that. Oh, man.
And now he got back to us. He's still wondering why somebody isn't answering his question. We're getting
all right,
there.
Remind me. Oh, I'm a failure.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me on IndieWire, where I interviewed Noah Baumbach and Elizabeth Marvel about the Maya Horowitz stories. I recommend reading that after you see the movie, which is on Netflix now and in more theaters than I would have thought, it turns out. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA70. You can find some of my writing over at Thrillist.com. You can also find Stoneroom Spoilers at fightinginthewarroom.com. That's my other podcast. This week, we're doing a whole bunch of comic book tomfoolery. There's a new Black Panther trailer. Joanna's seen The Runaways. Joanna's seen a lot of stuff. I don't know what we're going to squeeze out of her, but we're going to squeeze Joanna Robinson this week on Stone Spoilers.
Wow. Okay. As long as she says yes.
This is a consensual squeezing.
Consensual Jesus. Squeezing.
I'm Katie Ridge. You can find me at VanityFair.com with Joanna Robinson in any states you're being squeezed or not. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRICH, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we'd love to hear from you, and you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of the snowman, what's the worst movie tagline?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
You didn't yawn.
I didn't. Maybe I'm well rested.